Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable, a special edition of the Roundtable this morning. What a weekend. Don't know how else to say it. It was traumatic and troubling and unsettling and just a lot to think about and discuss. And we're going to do that this morning. We're going to do it for the full 3 hours. The way we're going to do it is 9 to 11 will be our normal panel, and we welcome your emails as you always email us, panel@wamc.org. From 11 to 12, we're going to do something we've never done on the Roundtable panel before. Those of you who have been with us since the very beginning of this program some 24 years ago know that we used to do something called the poll question of the day. So we have taken live calls. But we're going to do that again today, and without a poll question, but with some specific issues that we'll discuss just in the 11 o'clock hour. We have an amazing panel today, an extended panel, and we will I'll introduce them in just a second. And then we will get into all of what happened. I probably don't need to say this, but I'm going to anyway, just because I feel it's my duty as a good talk show host. We are hoping that there is a certain degree of civility and understanding, and that you will be. I think we all heard from the president last night of turning the temperature down, and we're hearing that actually from both sides. And I don't want this to turn into, you know, like who gets the best punchline in. I would really like it to be a conversation about where we're headed, where we're going, and what we can and should learn from this moment and these moments that have been delivered to us, one delivered to us over the weekend and really generally over the last several weeks. So there is a lot to talk about, and we will do that. And so I just ask you to be as the good people that you are. And we'd really appreciate that this morning. Let me introduce the group to you, and we will get started. We welcome UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies, Jennifer Burns. Good morning, Jennifer. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. Always happy to be here.
Very nice to have you here. We also welcome Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont. Hello, Malia.
Good morning, Joe. And I want to say, you're not a good talk show host. You are a fantastic talk show host. And I think it's one of the reasons I love coming here is what you just said about the what this program tries to do is it's a learning opportunity for all of us, and it's an opportunity for us to be in conversation. And one of the reasons this is a popular program is that people really enjoy that and they're hungry for it, and especially in circumstances like we're going to talk about today. So
yeah,
it's a privilege to be here, and thank you for creating this platform.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. We also welcome Terry Gibson to the program. Terry is a preceptor in public speaking for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University. Good morning, Mr. Gibson. How are you?
I'm very good. Thanks for having me. I just want to say I remember 24 years ago. I was there. I remember the call-ins and the poll questions.
Don't you miss them?
I kind of do, but I also remember the challenges that you and Alan had managing all of that. It's quite tricky, so it'll be interesting to see how it goes today.
That's why we didn't do it when we went over to the panel. We said, what's the one thing we want to change? Oh, that. Because we have a great call-in show. We have Vox Pop, and it's a fantastic program, and obviously Ray is a master at it. So, you don't need. But we're gonna be handling different subjects today, Medical Monday today, so we're going to handle the politics stuff on the roundtable. So, Terry, thank you very much for being here. Libby Post joins us, political consultant, lobbyist, and dear friend, and also a Monday regular. Good morning.
Yes. Hi, good morning.
Really good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
And investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman. Hello, Mark. How are you?
I'm good, Joe. If my weekend had been punctuated with the very
unfortunate news that we all heard on Saturday, I would have told you I had a great weekend.
It really put a pall over things, and I don't know. I think probably everyone had, you know, sort of different reactions to it. I was in Philadelphia. I was at Blobfest in Philadelphia, which is a celebration of the 1950s movie with Steve McQueen.
Oh, you're kidding.
The Blob.
Oh, wow.
Which was filmed right next to my hometown, which I didn't even know when I was a kid. And they have this festival they have for the past quarter century, and they celebrate the Blob. So you go and you see the Blob, and there's a scene in the Blob where the Blob takes over the movie theater in town. Well, the movie theater's still there. So what they do is during the movie, when the Blob comes out, then everyone runs out of the theater. You have a run out. And so we ran out of the theater, and as we were running out of the theater, you couldn't get a signal in the theater. So as we were running out, you just heard everybody's phone going ding 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 ding. It sounded like just a pinball machine. And that's when everybody started to look down and realize what had happened. And so it was really something. But it was, yeah, it's and then, of course, then you're glued to the television for the next 2 days and seeing what's going on and any information that you can possibly get. So we are going to go the full time. Some of our panelists will be able to stay with us. Others will have to leave at 11. But joining us later on will be Bob Griffin from SUNY and director of Dean of Homeland Security. And we will talk to him this morning as well. So we look forward to our conversation. I guess the best way to start this morning and sort of get a lay of the land from all of us and see what's happening there is just I'd like to kind of tell you what I think we know at this point. And then from there, I want to just hear from all the panelists as to what you make of it and just sort of what your key reactions are from that point. So here's what we know, and there's a lot we don't know. There's so much that we don't know. But by talking about what we do know, I think it leads us very easily into what we don't know. The former president was holding a rally in Butler, Pennsylvania, when he was shot in his ear. And two people, including the suspected gunman, were killed. Two others were critically injured. A man fired multiple shots toward the stage during President Donald Trump's rally in Butler, Pennsylvania, killing one spectator, critically injuring two others, according to the Secret Service. Mr. Trump was rushed off the stage, blood visible around his right ear. He was taken to a hospital, and the Secret Service said he was, quote, safe. The Secret Service also said its agents had killed the shooter, whom federal law enforcement officials identified as Thomas Matthew Crooks, a 20-year-old from Bethel Park, Pennsylvania. Senior FBI officials said on Sunday that agents were investigating the shooting as a possible domestic terrorism attack and assassination attempt. So, what we know about the shooting. Mr. Trump ducked quickly after the shots began, and as members of the crowd began to scream, Secret Service agents then rushed Mr. Trump off the stage. As he was escorted to the motorcade, Mr. Trump, whose face and right ear were bloodied, pumped his fist in a defiant gesture to the crowd, saying the word fight several times. He later said in a post on Truth Social, his social media platform, that he had been shot with a bullet that pierced the upper part of his right ear. He was taken to a hospital, later flew to New Jersey, where he was able to walk off the plane unaided. And last night he arrived in Wisconsin, for the Republican National Convention, which begins tonight. About the shooter, the Secret Service said the shooter had fired from an elevated position outside the rally venue before being killed by a sniper. According to New York Times data, they did an analysis and say there were 8 shots fired. That has not been confirmed by the Secret Service or the FBI. In a statement, the FBI identified the gunman, as I mentioned, Thomas Crooks, employed as a dietary aide at Bethel Park Skilled Nursing and Rehabilitation. He graduated with an associate's degree from the Community College of Allegheny County. He was a member of the Clareton Sportsman Club in Greater Pittsburgh, which features 200-yard rifle range, the club's legal counsel said in a statement. Law enforcement officials recovered an AR-15-type semi-automatic rifle from his body. The FBI said the weapon was legally purchased by the shooter's father, but it was unclear on Sunday how the shooter gained possession of the firearm. Among the gunman's possessions, the authorities also discovered a rudimentary explosive device, which was sent to the FBI's lab in Quantico, along with a phone and gun. There were two separate devices, rudimentary devices, that were found, one in the car, one at the shooter's home. The man who was killed was Corey Comparator, 50 years old, a father of two daughters, and he was at the rally. He died while he dove to cover his family, who accompanied him, according to Governor Josh Shapiro. The shooting happened as Mr. Trump was holding this large outdoor rally on grounds of the Butler Farm Show in Butler, a town of 13,000 people about 34 miles north of Pittsburgh. Mr. Trump had been showing supporters a chart about the number of border crossings just minutes into his speech when the shots rang out. Attendees screamed, get down, and shots fired. The Secret Service quickly cleared the press area, moved the crowd out, and declared the area a crime scene. Some Trump supporters held hands and prayed and chanted USA. World leaders and elected officials across the United States, Republican and Democrat, forcefully condemned the shooting as an affront to democracy. President Biden, in a nationally televised address from the Oval Office last night, discussed the need to lower the temperature in our politics. While we may disagree, we are not enemies. We must stand together. The president did call Donald Trump the night of the shooting, and both the president and the former president said that it was a very cordial and warm chat. So the big question, I think, as I said, a lot of what, when you say what we know, leads us to what we don't know. And I think the biggest question right now, and we'll get into this in some detail, especially when Bob joins us, but the big question is, how did someone with an AR-15 get within a few hundred feet of the president of the United States? And that is the question that is really before us. In addition to all of the other questions about how this will impact the presidential election, how this will impact the Trump campaign, the Biden campaign, everything, how it will impact us, how it will impact our society. There's a lot, and we're going to get into it this morning. All right. So, Malia, I'd like to begin with you on just sort of your overall thoughts as to what we all witnessed on Saturday night.
Right. Well, I had a similar experience to you. I wasn't in a movie theater, but I was up in the mountains in a cell phone dead zone. And when I came back down out of the mountains, like ding, 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 all the texts came in, like, what is going on? And I saw the news, and extremely sobering, to put it mildly, but for me, not especially surprising that a lone wolf had taken this kind of action. And you rightly point out one of the big questions is, you know, what happened with the Secret Service here? But for me, also understanding who this lone wolf is and how he was inspired, this is the biggest black hole of information for me right now. And it's really sort of fascinating that this person has very little online presence, that even the entire world wants to know who he is, and there's still very little information available about him. The military has been concerned about lone wolf extremism in the ranks for quite some time. And I was involved when Nidal Hussein, after he went on a shooting spree at Fort Hood, I was the lead action officer, this is in 2010, in developing the recommendations for how to how to respond to that, how to help commanders in the military identify potential lone wolf extremists. And the military has recently updated those regulations. But military commanders have a view of their troops that regular people don't have of their neighbors in the same way. And there's very little known about this family, except it doesn't fit into a neat box, right? I've seen a report that one of the parents is a Democrat, another's a Libertarian. This person was registered Republican, but also donated to progressive causes. I mean, so there's a lot of complexity here. And so I'm very eager to see what the FBI discovers on this person's cell phone.
You know, he's 20 years old, so there isn't much of a fingerprint, right? I mean, it's just he hasn't lived that long. He graduated from community college with an associate's degree, was working at this facility. And so, yeah, there isn't a lot.
There's some reports that just came out in the past hour that he tried to join his high school's gun club and was rejected because he wasn't skilled enough. And we don't know yet what the sequence is. Like, did he join the Claritin gun club before or after that? I want to be careful. Like, there are lots of guns and sportsmen's clubs here in New York and throughout the listening area, full of people who would never engage in this kind of political violence.
Well, and they run it safely, and they're done without incident, and
right.
with a very specific set of protocol that they adhere to.
Yeah,
I just want to a quick thing on the Secret Service. This will probably come up during our conversation, and there's a lot about the Secret Service that, you know, how did somebody get up on this roof? And my understanding is there's sort of three, and we'll get into this later, but there's kind of three circles, and you know, one is this inner core just around the president, then for the event, and then outside where mostly local authorities are overseeing the security of the area. Obviously, the Secret Service is overseeing all of that, but that's another thing we just don't know. So I don't want it to seem like we're bashing either the local authorities or the Secret Service, because we just don't know what that situation is yet. Where the Secret Service certainly deserves high praise is in the fact within seconds, the shooter was neutralized, and which is a horrible word, but it is the word that's used. So I will use it as well. And also, I think that while that happened, I mean, who knows what would have happened if he kept shooting? And that's another point that needs to be made. Terry Gibson, your thoughts?
Well, I had the same questions. To me, it just seems so easy for this shooter to have had access to the event and to that position. That just seems inexcusable, and somebody is going to have to answer for that. And it's important that we resolve it, because we just can't run campaigns in this country with the fear that candidates' lives are in jeopardy. I mean, that already, of course, exists just because of our history with assassinations and attempts. You know, I am old enough. Well, I was alive when both Kennedys were assassinated, but I don't really remember it. But I do remember when George Wallace was shot, and I remember the attempt on Gerald Ford's life. Certainly vividly remember the Reagan attempt. And those were the things that I thought of immediately, as soon as I heard the news, and thought that, you know, it's just another continuing episode of our country's engagement in this type of political violence. And it is really unfortunate. And I, like everyone else, found it to be very disturbing and confusing. And I'm still trying to make sense of how it's all going to play out and what this really means in the upcoming election. I know we'll have time to talk about that this morning. I, as a person who spends all their time studying communication and trying to teach people how to be better communicators, I'm particularly interested in how this changes the communication style, if it does, particularly former President Trump, but also President Biden. It is yet to be seen whether the lowering of the temperature that both are calling for will really happen. And I'm particularly interested to see if that message will carry on to their various surrogates, many of which have really engaged in the type of discourse that has often been criticized as dangerous rhetoric. I just don't know if that's really going to happen. And my sense is that we will eventually return back to kind of what it was, but it'll take some time to get there. We'll just have to see. A lot of unknown questions right now.
Absolutely. One note is that the president, in an interview overnight, said that he had rewritten his speech to take out a lot of the rhetoric of and sort of the more pointed attacks and tried to.
Which president?
Former President Trump, mm-hmm. speaking to the Republican National.
We'll see.
We'll see. Absolutely, we'll see. We'll see what that mm-hmm. What that reduction is like. What would you like to say, Libby?
I think it'll be about a week. The Republican convention will be over, and then things will go back to the way they had been. I think pulling ads off the air by the Biden campaign and giving Trump free media access, because he's not going to pull his ads off, is a strategic mistake. Do it for a day or two. Don't do it for a week. And let's not forget that the Republicans are already blaming the Democrats for this.
Some.
Okay? The Speaker of the House, Johnson, was clear that as far as he was concerned, this was a product of the anti-Trump rhetoric out of the Democratic Party, and how duplicitous. I mean, this Republican Party has taken projection to a new height, because they project all the things that they do on the people that they don't like and accuse them of doing what they're already doing. So, you know, we can't just. It was a horrible thing. I don't condone political violence. I think using political violence to make a point is, you know, part of the road to fascism. But let's see what Trump says, and let's see how the Republican Party really responds to this after the convention is over and he is crowned the king of the Republican Party. That kind of rhetoric is not going to change. He is, unless he's had some fundamental, you know, come to Jesus moment, he is not going to change as a person. I really don't think so. We'll see. I might be wrong. It would be great if I was, but I have a feeling we'll see things going right back to the way they were. And we, you know, the Democrats can't take their eye off the prize. I think that this will, you know, stop the hand rigging, the bedwetting, all the stuff that's going on in the Democratic Party. People need to coalesce again around Biden and move the presidential campaign forward.
Jennifer Burns.
So I agree a lot with what Libby said. I also think this is really an infighting between the Republican Party that, and I know that's not popular to say, but this is the escalation that when you look at the pattern of laughing at other people being attacked, mm-hmm. and the vitriol that you've fomented, boomerangs back when those rhinos want their party back. And I'm not saying that this young man, you know, falls into that group, but the framing by Tim Scott, by Mike Gentile, by J.D. Vance, who's looking, you know, to be maybe the vice president, that this is the projection that the Democrats and the liberals and they, those people on the other side, are the ones who have raised it to this point, is really ludicrous. We are looking at people like Paul Gosar. Remember the video, mm-hmm. that his staffer made that threatened to impale President Biden and to hurt AOC, the laughing at Pelosi's husband, the attack on the FBI, all of these things. And not to list them like, oh, he deserves this. But we've seen throughout history that when you foment these things, they are going to come back on people who do that. And we can't forget Marjorie Taylor Greene and the Christmas cards with, mm-hmm. Lauren Boebert and other posing with their guns.
And let's not forget Sarah Palin, right? She put out mailers to various congressional districts with bullseyes on them. And then the next, very shortly after that, Gabby Giffords was shot. And it was one of, and her district was targeted by that.
But it is, and I certainly understand the point, but we are seeing it on both sides.
I'm not going with that all the way. I'm going with neither. Biden had said from the start, as have Democrats, that we need to be more bipartisan. He had given many speeches throughout these last 4 or 5 years about unity and bringing the country back together, right? That was one of the things that he also ran on and talked about. And now we're falling really quickly into a both sides have done, mm-hmm. I think, in a very uneven kind of fashion.
I understand that. I'm talking about in the days following the shooting. And I also, because I mean, you had the an aide to Benny Thompson saying, mm-hmm. don't miss next time.
That's right.
You have many Democrats saying, you know, SEAL Team 6 wouldn't have missed. I mean, those aren't, that's not helpful. And that's not good for either side. And it's the same thing. It's mm-hmm. it's a temperature, and it's a school of thought that is, you know, I mean, and I will also say this, that, I mean, just even in the last week, as Biden has been recalibrating the campaign upon calls to step aside, there have been more direct attacks to the president and to his personality mm-hmm. and things that were sort of beneath him before. And I'm not saying any of that had anything to do with this, mm-hmm. but you do see the erosion, certainly.
Well, you see the shared language.
Right. Very much so. Oh, look, it's Mark Whitman. Let's hear from him.
Joe, I think it's important to mention that obviously our heart goes out to the deceased and their family and those who apparently were seriously injured and to Donald Trump and his family. But the thought that came to mind for me was in the wake of JFK's assassination in 1963, Malcolm X made the statement that the chickens had come home to roost. Mm-hmm. And because he said it while the nation was mourning, it was impolitic and he paid a high political price for having uttered those remarks. But I think if you look at Malcolm X broadly and that comment specifically, history has been far more favorable. The man stated uncomfortable truths. He was prescient and he offered oftentimes searing criticism. And I frankly think the chickens came home to roost on Saturday. And I think, as has been mentioned, I mean, you know, Donald Trump and the Republicans far more than the Democrats. I'm tired of this. I understand the media for a little bit, and the president and his role as president has to do a both-sidism for a while. We're not mourning, but we are shocked. And so we do many need to be politic. I frankly don't think I need to be politic. I think I need to be truthful. I think if you look at what Donald Trump has done since the moment he descended that escalator in terms of demeaning others, mm-hmm. the accelerant that he used effectively, which is social media, and what he's done to celebrate violence, and in his case, even to foment it. And I'm happy to give anyone who doesn't remember the list. The fact that now the flames that he set have lapped at his home mm-hmm. should surprise no one. And it's like a like a villain in a bad James Bond or Mission Impossible movie. When you let out the virus of hate, mm-hmm. it becomes uncontrollable. Mm-hmm. And no one should be surprised at what's happened. And further, if you add in the other accelerant here, which is these incredibly powerful weapons that there are now some 40 million of this country, and that this candidate and his party have promulgated as the God-given right of Americans to carry and use with very little restrictions, this further should surprise no one. Now, when I look at Donald Trump's remark at the beginning of his first campaign, I believe it was, when he said he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue without repercussions, unfortunately, I do think this will change the race. But I don't think it will change it in the way that people suspect. I think this will, unfortunately, from my vantage point, make it easier for Joe Biden to run out the clock and continue the lie that he is capable of leading the country over the next 4 years. And because of that, once I get beyond the personal cost that this shooting has cost, the political costs for me are daunting. I also wonder why there is no honor left in law enforcement. As with Uvalde, I would have expected that there would have been at least a couple of resignation letters on somebody's desk the next morning. The fact that that hasn't happened to me is perhaps unsurprising, but I think is profoundly disappointing. And finally, with respect to the shooter, who I feel sorry for them, I feel sorry for their parents and their family. I don't really care who they are in the following sense. This country, primarily as of late, the Republicans, have built up so much pressure and hate that it is probably unreasonable to expect that the security bubbles that we try to put around public figures will for always be impenetrable mm-hmm. with the pressures that we have built on the outside of those bubbles. And so I think it's right that we examine how to take it down, how to remove as much of the violence as we can from our political discussion. But I think none of this is surprising. I think we should get beyond this both side isms as quickly mm-hmm. as we can. And I do fear the political consequences because I think it'll allow Biden and his campaign to continue the lie and allow him to run a failed attempt to protect the office from Donald Trump and his people.
With that, we'll take a break. We welcome your letters, and we will hear from you this morning. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We'll continue our conversation on this special edition of the Roundtable after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have an extended panel this morning and a great group of individuals with us: Jennifer Burns, Malia DeMont, Terry Gibson, Libby Post, and Mark Whitman. We do welcome your letters, panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. Jordan writes, I would love nothing more than to see President Biden invite former President Trump to the White House and have a 10-minute televised conversation about moving forward. Regardless of who wins the election, Americans, myself, need to hear that we can move forward safely together. Then we go to Jay. I do hope that everything that has happened does turn things down and gets back to talks about policy, which should give Democrats a leg up. I feel the way Trump has always acted, insisted things like this to happen. But a cool down on both sides would be a lot better for the nation, and understand that both sides need to work together. And the letter is signed, love the show. So very nice of you, Jay. Thank you very much. We go to this letter from Abby. Who is responsible for payment of security in a political rally? Is it the candidate's campaign? If so, could limited funds have contributed to the poor security? Malia had to step out for a moment. She probably would be best suited to answer that question, unless any of you know. My understanding is that because you're dealing, that the security is much different from that of a being a former president
yeah.
as opposed to
right.
a candidate who has yeah. not held office before.
When he was not in elected office, the first campaign, he stiffed some localities not paying for the security that he was supposed to pay for. But now he's got Secret Service protection. He'll have it for the rest of his life because he's a former president.
But my understanding is that the security of the physical security of the president and a candidate, once they are granted that security, is the responsibility of the Secret Service. By the way, JFK has not yet been given security, which is
RFK Jr.
RFK Jr., thank you, which is a profound oversight. What Trump was stiffing people on were the security guards that help people park a mile away and the shuttle bus that gets them there and the rest of it. There's no escaping that the Secret Service is responsible here. The fact that there's been a little bit of trying to point towards local law enforcement is absurd. It's like when I travel the country and I use presentations, sometimes non-sensitive stuff is produced at a local copy shop. Well, if I don't get it to the client in time, it is my fault. I don't blame the local copy shop. That's absolutely absurd. And for the Secret Service to try and point a finger somewhere else, to me, just probably increases the list of names that ought not be working for the Secret Service.
Obviously, there's a lot of speculation, right, Terry? And everybody sort of, you know, well, did this happen? Why didn't this happen? And it leads us to think these things.
What's interesting to me, though, Joe, is that I would have thought, I know there's the hard perimeter and the soft perimeter, and this sounds like this was outside the perimeter, but I actually, in looking at the space, would have thought the Secret Service would have had someone stationed there because it seemed angular.
So close.
Well, right. And angular, right? Like you have some on one side and then you have others on the other side looking the opposite direction. So that part to me seemed a little confusing as to how they determine not just how far out they go, but the height of different locations that they would want to station people on to have a cross view.
There's also been a great deal of reporting that there were people who were in that perimeter, mm-hmm. sort of outside, who were saying, screaming, "There's a guy on the roof! There's a guy on the roof! There's a guy on the roof! There's a guy on the roof!" And felt very frustrated that people weren't responding to that. I guess there have been some answers to that. The protocol says that you can't respond to everyone, you know, saying this, because otherwise that takes you away from your task at hand.
Right. Well, there are other reports, too, that he circled the grass area, too, somehow before he got over to this warehouse and got inside of it, right? Well, that he was on the ground.
But is he and carrying an AR-15?
Well, we don't know if he was carrying that at the time. But if he didn't,
that means he left it up.
On the roof.
On the roof.
And there was also the device of whatever it was, the bomb-like device.
One of the relevant questions for me is how the Secret Service was coordinating with other authorities. Mm-hmm. So they obviously have primary responsibility for securing the site and making sure that the presumptive candidate, in this case, remains safe. But there's a lot of coordination with local law enforcement. And as we saw in the most complex example of this, January 6th, the breakdowns in communication between different levels of authority is part of what enabled that to turn into an absolute catastrophe. And I'm sure that as more investigation is done of Saturday's incident, then they're going to discover there were breakdowns. I mean, it's an obvious thing to say. There were breakdowns in communication, but where were they? It's not just internal to the Secret Service. I'm willing to bet that there was some kind of lack of coordination or whatever happened between the Secret Service and the local authorities who were supporting the Secret Service. It's not just the Secret Service within a certain perimeter, and then there's nothing outside of that. There, as you pointed out, there are circles of authority and responsibility.
And then that also suggests, right, that it could have been an area that was secured, and then they moved away from it to cover something else, because like Joe said, if there's calls elsewhere, they're looking at different things, which would have left the space kind of unsecured for a person to return or go to.
Terry?
Yeah, I think we are just going to find out in the near future that it was just incompetence. Someone did not do their job of securing the area and doing the final checks. I think it's what it's going to come down to. I don't know that it's really necessary to overanalyze it. Maybe I'm wrong. What it does do is it does play into the message that the Republican Party and especially Donald Trump have promoted for years now, that the FBI and the Secret Service are all rigged to get him, that they're all after him, that they're all siding with Biden, and Biden's using the government to come after him. It completely plays into that narrative and that message, and that's really unfortunate. And that just ties into my concerns that we were talking about before. I think a letter writer wrote in about whether this will move forward as a campaign that's about policy or not. And I have never seen any evidence in the last few years that Donald Trump or the Republican surrogates he relies on are really capable of talking about any policy except for defunding the government and making it less effective, but no real policy there. Or of course, you know, taking rights away from women. That's one of the policies they have. The Democratic Party and Joe Biden have definitely been talking about policy and talking about details. I think we could argue that they haven't been doing it very effectively. I don't think Joe Biden's been doing it very effectively, but I'm not confident that what has happened is going to change that narrative. I think you're going to continue to see Donald Trump and the Republican Party attack everyone that isn't supporting them, because if you take that away from their ability to communicate, there's nothing left. I mean, so many of the stars of the Republican Party right now have built their entire careers on angry, dangerous rhetoric, including Donald Trump. So if you remove that from their options of how to communicate, there's really nothing left. They become incredibly boring, and I don't see how to galvanize an audience. On the other hand, our particular candidate, our president right now, is not that exciting. It also has a tendency to be quite boring and sometimes incomprehensible. And so this is a real challenge in terms of communication for, I think, both parties and both candidates. And I'm just interested to see how it's going to play out.
Michael writes to us and says, would you be willing to talk about the impact that the members of your panel have had in decreasing the division and vitriol? It is possible to disagree with the policies and politics of the other side without the constant jokes, put-downs that you disagree with. There is incompetence and corruption on both sides. Why amplify only the problems on the other side? That from Michael.
Oh, I'll answer that. If the bar for political discourse, disagreeable political discourse, is set at the level of what's characteristic of the Democrats, we would be nowhere near where we are now in terms of this climate. So this isn't a case of a soccer referee who has to split the difference. We get to call it like it is. And there's only one party that's fomented hate and violence and laughed about violence to the degree that the Republican Party has. Does that mean that both sides are perfect, or that there aren't counterexamples amongst Democrats? Of course not.
Oh, my God.
Okay, we're just getting news in. CNN is reporting that the judge has dismissed the Trump classified documents indictment.
Welcome to dictatorship, folks.
This is the judge out of Florida,
who he appointed,
and so we've been obviously following that case, but we'll get much more information on that. While these plates are spinning over here, don't forget to look to the right or left and see where the other plates are spinning.
Yeah, does anyone thinks it's an accident that Eileen Cannon did that during the dust up of this weekend?
No.
Please raise their hand, because I've got things to sell you.
Yeah, right, like a bridge. I mean, really. No, this is all very well. I mean, not the shooting was well timed. I don't want to say that, but the aftermath of it. I mean, and this will be appealed, and we'll see how far it goes. But
Terry, anything on that?
I'm not surprised. All indications were that this was going to happen. It was just a matter of when she could find the appropriate time to do it. And clearly an opening happened this weekend.
All right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. So the way this morning is going to work, a little bit different than normal. We are going to have a news with Ray Graff. Well, that's as normal as you can get. And then we will come back. We will talk about other aspects of this weekend and talk about those issues. We will go until 11 o'clock. Coming up at 11 o'clock, we will have many members of our panel will stay on, and we will take your phone calls, and we will welcome your voice to be heard on the program this morning. We welcome you, and for the email portion, panel@wamc.org. We'll be doing that over the next hour. panel@wamc.org. We'll get to more of those letters, as well as more thoughts on other aspects of this weekend, coming up after news with Ray Graff.
And fade to the warmth of the rising sun. Won't you ride with me?
Good morning. Welcome back to our special edition of the Roundtable on this Monday, the 15th of July. We come to you on this Monday morning, following a horrific weekend where former President of the United States, Donald Trump, was the target of an assassination attempt. And at least that is what the FBI is calling it. And it certainly seems from all looks, it's exactly what was intended. The president is doing well, and will be speaking at the Republican National Convention this weekend has already arrived in Wisconsin for that event. We are going to noon today, talking about many issues that are happening. And, of course, there I just wanted to mention that we also are looking at Judge Eileen Cannon dismissing the Trump classified documents case over concerns about legality of special counsel's appointment. And I'm sure we'll pick that up and talk more about that as we get more information in. All right. Let's go to some of the letters, and we'll continue our conversation this morning. Jennifer Burns, Malia DeMont, Terry Gibson, Libby Post, Mark Whitman join us this morning. My hope is the penny may drop about assault weapons, writes Mary. Why are they available for civilians? Even more depressing is why does anyone want an AR-15? One of the first things I read within half an hour of the shooting was that this was a small caliber gun. And that obviously has turned out not to be the case. But it is, you know, will this bring any change to how we look at assault weapons in this country? I tend to doubt it, but I don't know.
I doubt it as well, although, I mean, this is not the first assassination attempt in our history, and previous attempts have led to various gun control measures that are still
in place.
Yeah, right, yeah. Exactly. So there's some kind of an opportunity here, but I'm not sure that, I don't think the politics in our country now are going to enable that.
If Sandy Hook, if Uvalde, if school shootings and the loss of innocent children didn't move.
Well, that doesn't tend to galvanize politicians the way getting personally shot at
I get,
does.
But yeah. It should. That's the thing. And if that didn't move people, our politicians, to change the gun laws and recognize that, you know, there used to be a ban on assault weapons in this country.
Well, I thought the Steve Scalise shooting would change.
Right, maybe, you know.
But it didn't.
But it didn't. And so now we are in a country where there are more guns than people.
I don't think there's any hope for two reasons. Number one, there are over 40 million of these AR-15-type weapons.
I don't think there's any hope either, Mark.
And we're not going to rest them out. The other issue here is when everyone talks about gun control, I think typically people say, well, I'm okay with weapons that are used for hunting. And this, by the way, the following statistic speaks to the failure of the Secret Service. A hunting rifle is good at about 300 yards. 400 is really pushing it. You got to be good and have good conditions. So if it wasn't an AR-15, it would have or could have been a decent hunting rifle. So I don't know that this helps contribute to that discussion, but I do think it underscores the failure of the Secret Service to permit this individual an advantaged shooting position on a clear, warm day. What happened from a security perspective is absolutely absurd.
Let's go.
I also just want to, I agree. I don't see how this really changes where we are with guns in this country, unfortunately. I think you're going to see a hardening on the right of wanting to try to have less gun regulation and more access to guns. I think they're going to use this as an excuse that they need more guns to defend themselves because we can't even trust law enforcement to protect us. We can't trust the Secret Service to protect us. I think they have a pretty good point right now when they make that message. It kind of comes down to this. If you are a voter or a citizen or a person living in this country that wants to see less guns and more restrictions on guns and safer communities and safer schools, then you want to vote for Democrats all the way down. And we need all both houses of Congress and the president to be a Democrat. And if that's not what you want, then you vote the opposite. It's really that clear cut. I do hope Democrats will use this as an opportunity to try to galvanize around
a message of the real need to elect Democrats so that we can have some gun reform. You know, the Brady bill, somebody brought that up, is a great example of how the philosophy and just really everything around the Republican Party has changed so much since Reagan. That Brady bill did come out after Reagan was shot. It was a time when the Republican Party still could be looked at by many of us as a reasonable party. We didn't agree, but we could agree to disagree. We could have civil discourse. You know, it wasn't perfect, but there could be mutual respect in most cases. But that's really changed, radically changed. Those people are all gone, and I just don't see anyone there. I was just looking at social media here to kind of see what the latest news is, and one of the things that's happening is you're seeing all of the various commercials that those on the extreme right, like Marjorie Taylor Greene, have made holding assault rifles and shooting mm-hmm. assault rifles. Yeah. It's a part of their messaging.
Let's go back to the letters and go to Anna. Thank you, Mark, for the reminder of Malcolm X. We need this speaking truth to hate and lies, and we will never get over it. Our history is rife with violence and repression. We need to expose it and have the courage to stand against it, or we will be plagued by this ugliness for the rest of our history, no matter how long or how short. That from Anna. Then we go to Mariana. Please verify or not something that I heard, that the shooter's father gave him the gun and his father bought it illegally. Those facts seem relevant in this conversation. I don't think we know that information.
It wasn't bought illegally. No, I think that's
it was bought legally yes. And it was bought by the father. What right. we don't know is how the shooter got the gun, of whether that was whether that was planned or not, and you know, whether he had access to it. We don't know any of that. But the gun was bought legally, and it was in the name of the father of the shooter.
There has been some reports that the shooter did go by ammunition himself, and that the records for that have been produced. So I don't want to say he knew he had access. I'm not going to say it was a gift or he was allowed to use it. But going to ammo up, knowing what style and kind of ammo you want to use, does indicate some for a plan.
I tell you, this gets a little technical, but this guy obviously thought he was a good shot and mm-hmm. was a little bit yeah. wrong, because if he whizzed one by his ear and wasn't shooting for the body mass, you could tell this guy thought he had it, the shot, and he clearly didn't. And conditions were pretty easy on Saturday. I don't know how windy it was, but it was a warm, clear day, and he had an advantaged position. I guess we're all very lucky that he mm-hmm. just this idiot overestimated his capabilities.
Catherine writes, there has been so much angry rhetoric. I'm tired of being called an evil Democrat / libtard. Mm-hmm. out to destroy the country, and yet find myself suspicious and quick to blame the other side for everything. I'm really trying not to do this. At the same time, we can't give this right-wing aggression, which has been building for years, a pass. January 6th is real. Also, at the same time, we and our Democratic silos hear generally about threats from the left, but are we being cushioned from much uglier things? And that from Catherine.
Catherine, if we want to feel collective blame for what happened, I have plenty of places to turn. We've got an education system that we're all responsible for, which has failed to inoculate these generations against what's happening with respect to social media. And we've also got economic privilege or elite in this country that has a really distorted view. Perhaps it derives from our Puritan history of luck. You know, a lot of people were really fortunate when globalization happened. It benefited the country en masse. But a lot of people were really unlucky just because of where they lived and what happened as a result of globalization. And many, many of those people are those that are now devoted followers of Trump because they think he's mm-hmm. got their interests and their economic interests at heart. And we as a whole nation failed ourselves in the education system. And when globalization happened, we failed those who were disadvantaged by it. and we're all paying a price. So there's plenty of blame to go around in this situation.
And Trump is not going to make sure that those people get any kind of economic advantage because he benefits from the globalization too.
Yeah, but that goes back to the – I mean, he's threatening to take away their health care, their rights to control their own health care and other issues. But that goes back to the education system that we as a nation have allowed to fail so many people.
I think part of what some people are struggling with is this these what seem like sometimes conflicting desires to be to engage in civil discourse and to, you know, be tolerant and try to understand where people are coming from, but also this desire for accountability for bad behavior. And these two things sometimes feel like they're in conflict, but they're actually not if you follow the law and the system of civil justice that we have in this country. But as we see this morning with the headline that just came over CNN with the you know Eileen Cannon dismissing the suit against Trump, there's we depend on the law to enable that accountability, and yet at the exact moment we need it most, more and more people are losing faith in it, or it seems like it is less impartial, or it actually is less impartial than it should be.
And let's also not forget that since we're talking about public education quite a bit here, that Project 2025 is very clearly calling for continual defunding of it and really turning everything into a private school where really religion is what really rules the lessons that are taught there. And so again, if you want robust public school funding, if you want fair and equitable public schools, if you want your children to be educated in a diverse environment where thinking and constructive criticism of all things is celebrated, then the Democratic Party is leading that fight.
I think the key to focus on for me in public education is that it's non-secular. Right. That's I mean, it sounds silly to have to say that, but that's really at the core of it. If you want religious education, then you go to a religious school. And there is this connection to the evangelical movement, which we've already seen too, saying that, you know, Trump was saved. Mm-hmm. It was a blessing. It was commanded by God because he still has a purpose. And this unity that's coming together using faith. Don't forget what's going on or what went on in Louisiana, right? Or was it Texas with the Ten Commandments?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Louisiana and Oklahoma.
And Oklahoma, right? So this right here, though, is also another one of those wings to, or I shouldn't say wings, I should say components that adds to an authoritarian state, right? When the law benefits one person in a way that's significant, like we're seeing with the Cannon decision right now, when religion comes in and begins to find a way that the person they're looking at is a savior, and even if he makes mistakes or he does sort of some bad things, it's just because he's a project God is working on for a bigger purpose, right? Those kind of arguments all fall into how you get more people to come into a authoritarian or fascist movement.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Somebody wrote this morning about how Trump could use this like Hitler used the Reichstag fire, right? And after that fire, you know, they blamed it on the communists. They blamed it on the Jews. They started the Holocaust in the early days, right, of making certain people not allowed to go out on the streets anymore and all that sort of stuff. And that was followed by Kristallnacht. So, you know, and then the Holocaust. So, you know, it's this notion of this right-wing Christian nationalist agenda, which is what Project 2025 is, or I've been reading they're trying to rebrand it as Agenda 47, right? And that they're changing page numbers and rewriting things or reordering things so that people can't find what's been put out.
What's been cited. Yep.
You know, but they want to get rid of Head Start. They want to get rid of Obamacare. They if you go to public schools, you have to serve in the military. Mm-hmm. If you go to private schools, you don't have to, right? And my favorite is that a real family is one with a working father, a stay-at-home mother and at least two children. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, they want us to go back to 1950, and we can't allow that to happen.
You know, it's interesting because there are real elements there that, as I was reading it, reminded me of just reading the handbooks and news articles written by segregationists. Mm-hmm. In the 1940s and the 1950s.
It's the same people.
Well, sometimes the same people, sometimes
same
children,
ilk.
Sometimes new, you know. But even going back to, like, what Mark said about Malcolm X, you know, one of the things that Malcolm X was talking about before that famous line was that he was laying out all of these different ways that people have not listened to Black people or poor white people, because by the time Malcolm X had made that, the chickens come home to roost in 63, he had begun to start to move into a larger embrace and separate himself a little bit from the Nation of Islam, because there was some corruption happening within there that he was beginning to see and call out. And so if you go back to that interview and you listen to it, he's pointing out all of these different ways that class and race and police corruption and law enforcement, the almost a growing prison industrial complex, all of those things were happening, and how African Americans and others who were the victims of it were not being listened to when they were laying out these connections and the entitlements people were having and the extra illegal way they were being to operate. But all the media did was jump on the chickens come home to roost part, to vilify him even more, to silence him even more. And I feel that that's part of what is happening now to some of the Democrats or others who are speaking against this. And this is not a new pattern. This is also what Trump and Republicans did to Republicans in their party who called him out for violating laws. Right? Or for going beyond his capacity, or dereliction of duty, or fomenting and supporting the insurrection. They too have been threatened and silenced, and there's been these little media clips taken and now corrupted against them.
We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. One of the panelists made a point of mentioning that the shooter had given money to liberal cause of some kind. I believe that was Malia. Laura writes this letter. I think this only serves to contribute to the partisan rhetoric we are at the same time trying to eliminate. If you're going to mention that fact, it would be the responsible thing to point out, to be factual, that he gave $15 to a group after January 6th when he was 17 years old.
Well, I think my entire point, so that person is zeroing in on one little part of my larger statement, which is this person didn't fall neatly into categories. This person is the son of a Democrat and a Libertarian. This person was a registered Republican, but also contributed. I mean, argumentation for the sake of argumentation.
Yes, absolutely. So then we go to this letter. This letter is from Bob. Not surprised. This is about the documents case being dropped in Florida. Not surprised the case got dismissed. How can you charge a president with having classified documents, which can be argued he has a right to them, but not change our current president with the same charge our current president with the same crime? But he has classified documents from as far back to when he was a senator, which he had no legal right to have them.
Do we have to go through this again? I mean, Trump refused to give them back, and then built
and lied about move it. Them, directed
well, no, but
people
then
to move them,
he literally
hide them.
Built a double cheeseburger of obstruction.
Mm-hmm.
First, he had his people move the documents and try to hide them from the FBI, and then he had them try to find and destroy the video of them doing. I mean, it was like literally like a double cheeseburger of obstruction. Apparently, the Washington Post, a legal commentator who covers the Supreme Court, had mentioned that in some of the decisions that were offered, Clarence Thomas had sort of winked that the special prosecutor was also a problem and something that might be found not constitutional, despite all of the other precedents. But given what the current court does, which is mm-hmm. make up its own law to fulfill its political purposes, nothing is beyond them at this point. And clearly what Eileen Cannon did was take that opening. Now it's certain that this won't be settled until after the next president is installed. And if it's Donald Trump, I just wait to want to see what happens to Eileen Cannon's position in the world, because I can't imagine it's hurt by a Donald Trump presidency.
No, she'll end
frankly.
Up being on the Supreme yeah. Court.
I don't. Yeah. I don't know that that should go that
but
far. But
what her decision, I think, does is throw every other special prosecutor's work under the microscope and capable of being thrown out.
Well, actually, that's an interesting point, Libby, because de facto, if the court rules in her favor that, and we're only going on snippets that we've heard, mm-hmm. that her issue with the case is that the special prosecutor has
right.
no standing, he would have no standing in the Jan 6 case in D.C. Mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. So she's certainly thrown a wrench into everything. Now, if we weren't facing a presidential election, Ty Cobb and other conservative lawyers, he used to be the lawyer for Trump,
right.
have said the sooner she makes a blatantly bad decision, the better, because the court above her can remove her and we can get on with life. The problem is we've got the added timer of when the presidential election happens and when the Justice Department is run by a new president, which Cannon obvious – well, one can speculate that she saw that handwriting on the wall and decided, if I'm going to go big, I might as well go big
she
now.
She may end up the next attorney general.
All right.
This does seem like this does seem to fit the definition of a pretty bad decision. I think this reason she is using is not one that anyone was expecting. It does seem to be based on one of the more far-fetched legal ideas, and it does seem to be actually connected to something that Justice Thomas wrote in one of his recent mm-hmm. opinions. And it seems like a slow sort of burn of her looking for a way to get out of this thing, and she's decided to grab on to this piece, but it seems like it could very well be overturned. But to Mark's point, will that be soon enough?
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We're halfway there. We have another hour and a half of discussion on the news of the day, of the week, of the weekend, of this election season that we'll be marching toward. We'll have a half hour of conversation with your letters, and then at 11 o'clock, we'll go to the phones. We welcome you. And for right now, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll continue our conversation after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Jennifer Burns, Malia Dumont, Terry Gibson, Libby Post, and Mark Whitman. And we'll be with you until noon today. We thank you for being with us as we try to discuss, analyze, make sense of what has been happening in our country. So here we go. We begin, go to letters and say this from Jim. As you were discussing, no, that one didn't make the cut. Sorry about that. Let's go to Sheila. Just wanted to ask if the panel at some point could discuss something I saw in a community Facebook group yesterday. The post stated that the Democrats are the true threat to democracy due to what they described is unethical and undemocratic means of choosing their candidates over some election cycles. Examples listed were pushing Bernie Sanders out in favor of Hillary Clinton and others that I can't remember, but Joe Biden's refusal to step down was noted as well. I certainly won't be voting Republican, but I feel there is some truth to the facts they pointed out, and that only makes it harder to try to convince undecided voters to go Democratic rather than Republican. And I am extremely frustrated with the Democratic Party with their complete lack of planning and strategy. Go Libby Post.
Look, I understand where what people are saying and why they're saying it. But as a friend of mine from my synagogue, Barry Pollack, wrote to me, vote blue no matter who, vote red and democracy's dead. And that's absolutely true. Trump, if he is elected and Project 2025 becomes his calling card and his agenda, we are sunk. My marriage will be undone. Women will be seen as more as chattel as they ever have been before, and property. This will become a Christian nationalist country, which is what they want. Public education will be undone. college education will only be available for the rich, and we will return back to a time when democracy was not valued as it was when my father fought in World War II. And I've said this before, there are very, very few World War II vets left, period. And there hasn't been any in Congress in a very long time. And having those vets in Congress, even if it was Bob Dole, right, who was conservative, but he understood what it meant to fight fascism. And none of these people in Congress, you know, the Marjorie Taylor Greens, the J.D. Vances, the Boberts, all of them, they don't know what fascism is. They don't understand what it means. And they think what they're doing is upholding the Constitution and democracy when it's really just undermining it. And I've seen this erode over the years, right? And, you know, my dad fought in the war. A lot of my, I'm 66, a lot of my friends, my father's friends, my friends' fathers fought in the war. And they understood what they were fighting for. And these people just don't get it. And we're going to go down a road that it will be very hard to come back from. I think ultimately we probably will, but it might be after I'm dead.
And Joe, just to add to that, if I could, to the letter writer's point, I think it's also important that we not confuse the political process of choosing a candidate on either side, which is a very cumbersome process, with the agendas that the parties have, which are distinctly different, as Libby has indicated. The idea that somehow Bernie Sanders not being allowed to proceed as the presidential candidate, or how Hillary Clinton handled her campaign, or how Joe Biden ended up being the candidate, you know, we can argue about whether all of that was right or wrong. I personally would have liked to have seen a real primary in the Democratic Party, but I don't think it's right to accuse that process of being unethical. It's all done through a legal procedure through the Democratic Party, and the process that was used is the same process that's been used since the beginning of political parties, and it's the same process that's used in the Republican Party to choose Donald Trump. It's ugly. It's not always fair. It is does not always produce the best candidate. But it is the system, it is the process, and I think it's just important that we not label that as somehow being a reason not to vote for a candidate or that being unethical. Ultimately, we have these candidates. You have to understand what they stand for. It's very different ideologies, and we're going to have to pick between these two.
Terry, I respect your view, but I vehemently disagree. I think what the Democrats have done is unethical. What Joe Biden and his handlers did is actually eerily analogous to what Donald Trump and the Republicans did on January 6th. We all saw it, and after the fact, they tell us, no, they were just tourists, they were invited in, don't worry. I know that, now know, particularly after the debate, that Joe Biden, given his infirmities, is incapable of being president for the next 4.5 years. The Democrats have told me he had a bad night. He didn't get enough sleep. He was too full of facts. He had traveled too much. They're lying to the American public to try and sustain his candidacy. They are intentionally deceiving us. I don't know if that's undemocratic or not. I actually do think it falls within the confines of the rules. But I do think it is unethical, and I find it very troubling now that both parties have tried to pull the same nonsense over the eyes of the American public. When it comes to what to do about it, I share your and Libby's fears about what happens if the Republicans take control. And so I'm going to do a couple things. I'm going to make sure that I vote and support every Democrat I can everywhere, because the problem with Republicans, even those who currently state they're against Donald Trump, is when they get scratched or bitten, they seem to get infected by the same virus and all line up. The one thing I will do in New York is, if the day before the election it looks like the Democrats will still carry the election and Joe Biden is their candidate, because my vote won't on an individual basis matter for the presidential line, I will make sure I do not cast a Democratic vote.
Don't do that, Mark.
Because
do
I'm upset
not,
with...
And, do not and, do that.
And I'm happy to listen to why I shouldn't.
Because every vote counts. And if you do, oh, I'm going to do a protest vote, too many people will say the same thing. Okay? Do not do that. Your vote counts. If you want to save this democracy, you're going to have to hold your nose if you don't like Joe Biden and vote for him, regardless of how things look, because you never know. Remember what happened in 2020. all the polls said Hillary was going to win, and Trump did.
2016.
In 2016, and Trump won. Do not do that. It's a dangerous game that you're playing.
If I were in a swing state, I would agree.
No, it doesn't matter.
I think it's make the vote and then recalibrate after the win. Because the other thing that's happening here is that the numbers really, really matter, because we do have a candidate, and I don't know how much this is going to change this week with the Republican National Convention, who has many underlings who contest the validity of elections to begin with.
Right.
And so when those numbers are not on the books and recorded, it creates more room to challenge voter integrity and things like that.
The one thing I would say, Libby, is if my vote is what matters in New York State, Joe Biden has long lost that election.
No, everyone's vote matters in New York State. Everyone who's going to vote Democratic, each and every one of those votes matter.
If New York goes red, where are we?
It doesn't matter. You're giving up your franchise because you're pissed.
No, I'm using my franchise to
No, you're giving it up.
The nonsense.
If you don't vote, you're giving up your franchise.
But that protest could contribute to supporting the nonsense.
Right,
winning.
Supporting the nonsense.
It's like take the win and then the next day let's regroup to create this other strategy we want to put in place.
And Mark, I'm not sure. Someone has been lied to in some of these circumstances, clearly. But I'm not sure that it was a lot of deliberate lying to the American people by Democratic leaders. I think many of them were lying to themselves and have been living in a bubble of wishful thinking. I wasn't surprised by Biden's debate performance, but a lot of people were. And those people who were, I think they've been living in wishful thinking land, and now they've been forced to come out of it. And so that's the reckoning that's happening right now in the Democratic Party. And in terms of what's going to happen next with that, I think based on the debate performance and what happened this weekend, I think there's a slow shift towards thinking that Biden shouldn't be the candidate anymore. And what's the time? I mean, nobody except Kamala Harris can really legally, I mean, getting back to the question of what's legal and ethical, is legally in a position to become the candidate in time. And I think if Democrats are going to make this move, the Democratic Party is going to make this move, probably the timing for it would be right after the Republican convention.
Well, but let's just sort through this. I agree that some people are probably delusional, and Joe Biden, key amongst them, may be the one. But let's talk about Kamala Harris. If Joe Biden resigns, Kamala Harris is the only one who could become president. If Joe Biden steps down as a candidate and says, all my delegates can do whatever the heck they want.
But they can't get on the ballot in all these different, like how they get on the ballot in the different states. I think that's what's in question.
What has to happen is the Democrats, if Biden steps down and says he's not going to run, the Democrats have to go into their convention lockstep with a nominee without any without any arguments on the floor, no floor fights, no nothing, okay? So that it's seen as we are united behind whoever this person is going to be. If they go into that convention with floor fights and division, Trump automatically gets elected because we weaken the candidate.
I understand your view. I think Malia is highlighting something different, saying that the Republican nominee, if it were not Joe Biden and were not Kamala Harris. Sorry. The Democratic nominee, if it weren't Biden or Harris, doesn't have enough time to get registered in all the states?
It has to be done at the convention. It cannot be done state by state. It has to be done at the convention.
Yeah, you got
to
win the nomination.
But at the convention.
Are we agreed that if you win the nomination, you've got enough time to be president?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
You'll be on the ballot.
I go back to what I said a week ago, and I was only half kidding. I think you ought to appoint a group of elder statesmen, Obama, Clinton, Liz Cheney, if she'll get on board. And I'm serious about her, by the way, because I think you ought to force the party as centrist as it can stomach. I think you ought to run a reality show between now and the convention. I'm not averse. You tap people on the shoulder and say, "If you, by the way, you run the events in swing states, because that's what matters." I think it, periodically everybody who gets in agrees that if you're tapped on the shoulder by the committee, you step out. I don't mind if a little fur flies at the convention to make it fun. America loves a reality show. We could steal back the oxygen from Donald Trump. He is the reality TV president, for God's sake. And if your reality TV show is about a serious discussion of the issues and the contrast between the Democrats and the Republicans, democracy benefits.
Yeah,
and if you got to use that, Mark Burnett to produce it, who, by the way, is the guy who made Trump famous on
The Apprentice. Right.
Right.
And Survivor.
Amen. Let's have it.
It's interesting, though. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Terry.
It's okay. It's a free-for-all.
Right. Which is what Mark is wanting on the Democratic floor of the convention.
So I just want to say a couple things. First, Mark, I'm with you more than I'm against you. And your idea of how we should run the remainder of this election is intriguing to me. And I kind of am on your side of wanting to see that. But I do want to be clear in terms of your concerns about ethics and honesty, integrity. If we were to have a process, as you just described, don't let any of us kid ourselves in thinking that there wouldn't be lying and deceit in that process. Mm-hmm. The political systems that we have within the parties, the way they're set up, both parties, almost necessitates some level of lying and deceit on top of campaigns to be able to get to the level where they can become the nominee. It's just part of the system. It's ugly. But we shouldn't live in this fantasy that we somehow have this pure political system where the people that rise at the top are these honest, pristine people that have never gazed in line. Look at any president that has ever made it to that level to become the nominee or the president. You are going to find some level of lying and deceit on both parties all the way back. You know, I mean, we have lots of examples. Think about when Reagan was president, and we know now that he was suffering from Alzheimer's. They hid that. We have an example of President Wilson, where his wife was essentially running the White House for years without the public knowing. So we do have a history of this deceit, and I think it's important to acknowledge that, and I think it's important to fight against it and to try to change it. We shouldn't accept it. But at the end of the day, we will have candidates that are nominated through this clunky, awful process, and we have to choose between what they stand for. And what these candidates stand for, regardless of how they got there, are very, very different.
We have to go to a break, but before we do that, what say you, Mark Whitman?
I get your point about deceit being, unfortunately, a part of politics, but the Republicans proffered what we call the big lie. Unfortunately, the Democrats have been proffering a pretty big lie themselves in terms of Joe Biden's competency. We need to move beyond it.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll continue right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Will you just make up?
We love each other. Not to worry.
Just stop it and make up. Okay. Welcome back to the roundtable. So the way this is going to work, we're going to go for about eight minutes or so, and then we're going to take your what's left of we have emails. Anybody who wants to do an email now, you can. And then we're going to take a news break at the top of the hour. We're going to have news, and then we're going to come back to us, and we're going to do 1 hour of discussion with calls. And if you would like to get in early, and I don't know, as I said at the beginning of the program, we've never done this before. So if we don't know how it's going to go. But so we'll give you the number at 11 o'clock and when we're staffed and ready, and then we'll go to town. All right. Mm-hmm. Here we go. Time to go to letters and try to get as much as we can. Kathy says to Mark, please do not strategize about not voting for the office of president. Here in Sullivan County, I know many people who object to his actions in Gaza in support of Israel who plan to do exactly what you are suggesting. If enough people do that, it could affect the election. That from Kathy. Then we go to this note from Spencer. Quibbling over which political party is more responsible for this climate of vitriol and violence is tragically laughable. Should any of us be surprised, our representatives on both sides have chosen to deal with all manner of perceived threats around the world with dehumanization, violence, and slaughter, including assassination, for at least the last 75 years. I have news for you, Mark. We're all responsible. Thank you for a truly great panel today, Spencer.
You're welcome.
Then we go to George. On September 6th, Trump told security guards to allow the crowd to bypass the gun detectors because supporters carrying guns were not there to come after him. This may be contributed to a culture of a lax security at his rallies, especially in an open carry state. I mean, obviously, that is an opinion and...
Is Pennsylvania an open carry state?
I didn't.
I know.
I didn't think it was.
No,
I think
Wisconsin is, and so there's major concern about the what's it called again? Hard and soft
perimeters,
because they've said that the building there itself is secure. Is the hard perimeter, and then like the sidewalks outside, the traffic will be directed and all those things, but that's considered the soft perimeter. So because the state has open carry, people can move through there with their guns.
Joe in panel writes, Andrew, I would like to hear your opinion on this double standard. There was an assassination attempt on Nancy Pelosi. The killer who broke into her house was attempting to kill her and did not know she wasn't home. As it turns out, her husband was, and he attempted to kill him. At the time, Nancy was third in line to succession of the presidency and Speaker of the House. Let's compare how the Republicans treated this compared to how the Democrats are handling this weekend's attempt. First of all, I mean, calling him a killer, there was no one killed in that. I just want to clarify that. But go ahead. Anyone on that?
No, you call him a would-be killer. And I think that recent history is replete. I mean, not only did Donald Trump laugh about that attack, but he also questioned whether or not he agreed with those who were trying to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. So the person who wrote in that said America broadly is responsible for this violence, I get that. But I think if you look as to which party has more recently turned up the volume, sown hate, accelerated with the use of social media, and condoned and laughed about violence, I think there's only one party that fits that criteria.
And isn't it interesting, right, that there is no talk. This has galvanized all of them to continue to back behind and nominate Trump, right? As much as they're coming together to say, let's be kind, and they're playing a nicey-nice, and, you know, like that we're going to work together, and the rhetoric's been too high, and all of these things, that's great talking points that'll feel really good for the next week, and they'll continue to be able to say his life was threatened, and they'll come back to that. And conveniently, they're not really looking at any of the other circumstances that also are part of this candidate's repertoire.
Right. Go to a few more letters, and this from Richard. Yesterday, a reporter with ABC spoke with a high school classmate of the shooter. The classmate was direct and obviously knowing. He said with sadness that the young man was always alone, often bullied. Alone, bullied, and access to a gun. And he just leaves it at that.
Well, it's so interesting. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
In the New York Times this weekend, there was a big essay, sort of a follow-up with Robert Putnam, who is well-known for writing this book several decades ago, Bowling Alone, that was looking at this sort of the dissolution of American civic life. And so they're checking in with him a couple decades later as we're heading into this next presidential campaign. And he just outlined how all these trends are getting worse. And and so one thing we haven't talked about that much on the panel yet is that, you know, this is a disaffected young man, a really young man, right? And so what those of us who are working directly with young people on a regular basis, I think a lot of us notice that this current generation has a distrust, a lot of them distrust of institutions. There's less of an understanding of how important institutions are and how they function. and also a lack of interest in understanding mm-hmm. those things because of the distrust. So it sort of engenders this spiral. And I have a feeling we're going to find out that this young man was caught up in that.
What was interesting
we're gonna pause.
Okay.
We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll have our call-in aspect of our program this morning. Terry has to drop out. He has to go work at Harvard. Terry, thank you very much, as always. We appreciate you being here.
Okay, thanks for having me.
All right, thank you very much. We welcome you to join us to get in to be on the line. We want you to call 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. We'll go to your calls. We'll have the discussion. I'll give you the rundown of the panelists and all of that after we take this short break.